From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Growing up in the 60s and 70s, I was acutely aware of the difference in voice between cookbooks written by men and those written by women. The women became my aunties, whispering, guiding me in a world not yet influenced by millions of food photos that live in clouds. Marcella, Najmi, Elena, I knew all of them on a first-name basis, even if we never met. Nearly all of them were immigrant women who were given short shrift, not TV personalities, but trailblazers nevertheless. Award-winning writer Mayuk Sen looks at seven immigrant women, tastemakers who left a lasting mark on our culinary landscape. Hi, Mayuk.
Hello, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the new book is wonderful, and it's such an unusual idea to take a look back. I feel like not enough people look back in this weird, raging food media world we live in. And context, I really believe, can be everything sometimes. So to give our listeners some context, can you quickly name each of the women you profile in your new book and the name of the book that brought them to their public?
Absolutely. Well, there's Chaoyang Bue from China, who wrote in 1945's How to Cook and Eat in Chinese. There's Elena Zelaya, who wrote a number of cookbooks beginning in the 1940s, focusing on Mexican and Spanish cooking. Then we've got Madeleine Camin from France, and her most famous work might be When French Women Cook, which came out in the mid-1970s. Then we've got Marcella Hazan, who really made her mark beginning with 1973's The Classic Italian Cookbook, followed by Julie Sani, who wrote 1980's Classic Indian Cooking. Then we've got Najmi Batmanglij from Iran, who wrote 1986's Food of Life. And then I end my book with the story of Norma Shirley from Jamaica, who sadly does not have a cookbook to her name, yet definitely left a lasting impression on the way Americans cook and eat today.
So I would love it if we could start off by talking about Chaoyang Bue, the woman who wrote How to Cook and Eat in Chinese. She's credited with exposing the cuisine to a larger American audience. She had a career before its writing. Can you share a bit about her life and also how her family reacted to her voice?
Totally, yes. So Chaoyang Bue, she was born in China, and this was in the 19th century. And before she came to America in 1921, she had a really vibrant, flourishing career as a doctor in China. And she had gone to medical school in Japan, which was pretty radical for its era, at least in my understanding. Yet she came to America because her husband, the famed linguist Chao Yanren, he had gotten an academic job in America, and as a result, they were transplanted to the East Coast. And because of her lack of fluency or comfort with the English language, she couldn't find work as a doctor in America. And so instead, what she did was she busied herself with cooking, and she became exactly what she feared, which was a housewife. Yet she created a career out of cooking by writing that cookbook, 1945's aforementioned How to Cook and Eat in Chinese. Yet the genesis of that cookbook was quite tortured because her eldest daughter, Rulan, helped her in putting the words to the page. But then it was her husband who looked at that draft and said, no, this is all wrong, allegedly. And as a result, he kind of went through it with a red pen and struck out a lot of Bue's own voice and said, grafted his own onto the text. So as a result, this pioneering cookbook is this sort of clash of different voices and styles. And you can see the sort of family conflict right on the page, which is absolutely fascinating. Yet it saddens me because the voice of Bue, herself, was effectively obscured in spite of her great contributions to the way that Americans cook and eat today.
So our station lives in Santa Monica, and we're centered, a lot of our content is about California and Southern California. And I would love it if you could talk about Elena Zelaya. She is such a fascinating figure. And I've had her book, one of her books, for years and years and years. And I often will just open the pages and start reading it because I think about her story and how extraordinary it was.
Absolutely. She is a truly rich, fascinating character in pure narrative terms. So Elena Zelaya was born in Mexico in the late 19th century, yet she came to America and specifically California's Bay Area in the early 20th century and was displaced here as a result of the Mexican Revolution. And she made a career as a cookbook author, a one-time restaurant chef, and occasional television cooking host in spite of many challenges throughout her life. The primary one being that she lost her sight as an adult. And afterwards, she taught herself how to cook again, relying on all of her other remaining senses. And that spirit of tenacity I found so inspiring, and she was really able to make a career out of it. And she really did provide a sense of hope to her audience in America, especially in the post-war years. Yet, I'm sad to say that I'm sure that very few American home cooks today really know her name in spite of her impact. And that's kind of what I wanted to try and correct with this book.
Yeah, I mean, she in particular is so interesting to me because her parents were actually Spanish.
Exactly.
So she grew up in Mexico, this place that had been so deeply colonized. And she had this experience of Mexican food, but also the overlay of her parents' memories. And then all of her time in California, because she became known as an authority of West Coast cooking.
Yes, which I find so fascinating, which is that she wasn't just relegated in kind of popular culture in the time to being the poster child, so to speak, for Mexican cooking or just Spanish cooking. It was for West Coast cooking or California cuisine. She was good friends with Helen Evans Brown, who was another incredibly significant figure in California cuisine. And it's fascinating because Elena Zelaya's sensibility really started to reflect her adoptive home over time. You know, you see that as you kind of look through her bibliography, you know, her initial cookbooks were really just focused on Mexican and Spanish recipes, at least in framing. Yet as time went on, she started to write books about California foods, and you saw recipes that borrowed ingredients or techniques from Japan and Italy and other immigrant populations that existed within California. And she was absolutely content to have her food reflect the person she had become by living in America. And perhaps her feeling of outsiderness in Mexico itself may have contributed to that. I don't know.
So Norma Shirley, tell us about her and your decision to include her, despite the fact that there isn't a book that we can turn to, is an interesting one and puts more responsibility on you in a way.
Yes, that was its own kind of challenge to write about a deceased subject who did not leave behind any memoirs or cookbooks with memoiristic passages that I could really rely on. Thankfully, she had a family who was quite open with me. And in addition to that, she had many interviews that she had given throughout her lifetime that really presented her vivid personality and put it on full display. So Norma Shirley, for listeners who aren't familiar, was a chef and restaurateur from Jamaica who came to America, I believe, in the late 1960s. And during the 1970s, she operated a very popular restaurants in the Berkshires in Massachusetts that cooked French food with Jamaican flair, is how I believe she put it. And after a few years of running that restaurant, she decided that she wanted to strike out on her own in New York and just kind of try out, running her own restaurants in the Big Apple. And so she moved there as a single mother with her son. And upon coming to New York in the early 1980s, she really struggled to gain sufficient capital and investors who could really help her mount that restaurant of hers. And so after a few years, she decided that it was not worth the pain or struggle of trying to make this a futile dream happen. And so she returned to Jamaica in the mid-1980s. And it was only then, when she experienced real success as a restaurateur by opening a spate of restaurants under her own name in Jamaica. And those restaurants are the ones that got her the attention of the American food media. Suddenly, magazines like Vogue and Bon Appetit and Food and Wine were feting her as the Julia Child of Jamaica and the Julia Child of the Caribbean. And I was so intrigued by her story because this was a Black immigrant woman who was working in a time before the American food establishment was really willing to understand the nuance and beauty of Jamaican cooking, the kind that she was trying to impart upon her audience. And it was only after she left America and returned to Jamaica that she was able to make a living doing what she loved and expressing herself creatively. And I felt as though that was a real indictment of the American food establishment and the American food industry and who it makes room for.
Well, thank you so much for having the kind of curiosity you do and the commitment to tell the stories that you love. It's really a marvelous book. And I have to tell you, when I first opened it, it just made me want to run around and grab all the books I have from these women and revisit them.
Oh, well, I'm really touched to hear that. And I really do hope that other readers have that sort of same generous response.
That was Mayuk Sen. He's a James Beard Award-winning professor of food journalism at NYU. His most recent work is Tastemakers, Seven Immigrant Women Who Revolutionized Food in America. Up next, I don't think there's been a year that I can remember without a new Yotam Ottolenghi book to mark the holiday gifting season. He joins us next with his co-author, Noor Mourad, to tell us how to resurrect the forgotten ingredients in the back of your pantry.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Everyone has that one shelf at the back of the pantry with a can, a jar, a bag, or a box from a bygone era. Perhaps last year you reconnected with these forgotten ingredients stashed away. The team at Ottolenghi Test Kitchen have created recipes to resurrect items in the cupboard, freezer, and fridge, something they're calling shelf love. We're joined by Noor Mourad and Yotam Ottolenghi himself. Hi, you two.
Hi.
Hi, Evan.
So this book was so clearly made for the times we're living in when, the supply chain is disrupted and we may not have access to things that we're accustomed to have. I'm wondering, Yotam, if you can describe the this for that ethos that is in the book.
At that crucial moment last year when we realized that our world has really changed, it was really important for us to tell people who are cooking, you could really be quite flexible when you cook, especially at this moment in history when there is these shortages and it's quite difficult to go out and buy what you normally used to have on your shelves or in your pantry. And it's absolutely, totally legit to swap one thing for another. And we actually encourage you to do that. So if you use, let's say, instead of a dried chickpea, you can use a cannellini bean or a butter bean, and you're going to get a similar result. Or you can swap one spice for another spice, one kind of veg for another. All these things are are something you should be doing, not only because, you know, it means that it gives you a certain flexibility that we need, but also it makes you into a better cook because it means that you're exercising confidence and a vision. And one of the missions, if you'd like, in this book is really to give people the confidence to change and adapt recipes. We left little space at the bottom of every recipe, the way you can, like old school, you know, like a home recipe book, make your notes and make your marks for future cooking. Then that's all about that flexibility that we encourage people to exercise.
So I'm wondering if the two of you are open to play a tiny game with me for a minute. I would love to tell you a pantry item that I haven't taken out for a spin in a while, and you tell me what I can do with it.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay, so I have a bag of beautiful, very fine semolina from Italy that I bought. I was so happy when I bought it, and yet it's languished there in my pantry without being open for a while. What can I do with it?
There's a semolina recipe in that one shelf in the back of your pantry, actually, in Shelf Love, which uses up a bag of semolina. I think a lot of people might have bags of things that they've used one time for a recipe that called for it. And I think what we try to do is kind of create recipes based off of those one dry ingredient. So the semolina porridge is just a bowl of comfort semolina cooked with coconut milk. And it's also with blitz corn and garlic. And it's just very delicious, very humble vegan dish that you could have for breakfast. Or you could make it even more substantial by adding an egg. And that is something that just kind of came to life based on one bag of semolina.
Well, I would never think of cooking semolina with coconut milk. And I have both those things. Okay, so what about mince, or as we call it, ground beef?
I would add, I would actually connect the two because it's something that I had quite a lot growing up. So I would combine the semolina with the ground beef. And so my dad used to make a lot of polenta, and you can make polenta, you know, runny polenta also from semolina. You can also make firm polenta from semolina. And my dad used to make like a ragu bianco kind of thing with minced beef. So sauteed carrot and celery and hard herbs like sage or thyme or rosemary or a combination of those, and allow the beef to really cook in that oil with all those aromatics and vegetables. And it would kind of burn it, so you get like kind of crispy bit of beef. And then he wouldn't add like tomato paste or tomato sauce, but just a couple of like small tomatoes just to give it a little bit of acidity and a tiny bit of stock. And that would be a sauce. So a very kind of minimal. It's all about the flavor of the beef. And that he would serve with semolina, and it's simple and it's delicious. And you can grate cheese on top if you want, but you don't have to. And I would just put those two together.
Oh, I love those. Yeah. You also have thoughts on what for some people might be obscure items that we might not all have, but may run out to purchase to make some of these dishes. I actually have a funny story about black limes from when I was in Italy in September. I wanted to vegetarianize a Persian dish, a horesh badamjan for a friend, but of course she had no black limes. Then I was visiting another friend and I mentioned this, you know, is there anywhere in Rome I could find black limes? And she looked at me in the strangest way and she said, "We just got this package from Dubai." And in it was this big bag of black limes.
That's the good stuff.
Yeah, such a bizarre thing. So tell us about them.
Well, I think black limes for some people might be a bit obscure, but in the Gulf and my part of the world and other parts of the Middle East is such a common ingredient. It's essentially just a lime that's been salt treated and then dried out in the sun until it's completely hollow on the inside and quite hard. And it's got like this bitter, quite sour flavor. It's a very deep, intense flavor that you can use to flavor things like soups and stews and rice dishes. If you just poke a few holes in it and just throw it in, one goes a very long way. You can also grind it up and use it as a marinade for things. It's a great tenderizer for meats. And it's such a versatile ingredient, and they also last forever. You know, they stay on your shelf for a really long time. So it's really worth, you know, getting a friend who has a bag of limes from Dubai because then you can, you know, those black limes are going to last on your shelf for quite some time.
So many of us subscribed to produce boxes during the pandemic that would arrive full of beautiful and often ingredients that we hadn't used before. Can we talk for a minute about some of the seasonal ingredients we might be receiving now, like sweet potatoes or different kinds of winter squash?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to talk about this incredible shakshuka that we have in the book for sweet potatoes that Noor created. And it's such a great way to use up sweet potato. And it's also a very easy way. So essentially, you scoop out the flesh, and that becomes the base of your shakshuka. You add feta to it, some cumin, garlic, and well, you put it in a pan with some oil, and as the sweet potato flesh heats up, because of the sugar level, it kind of crisps up on the bottom. Then eggs are broken in and like slowly cooked, like you would a shakshuka. And it's so wonderful and delicious. And it's finished with chili butter and some cilantro. And it's just one of those things that just shows how clever Noor is, because you wouldn't put these two things together, but she did, and it's so wonderfully delicious. And it's a brunch thing or light supper, and it's absolutely wonderful.
Yotam and Noor, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us from London. It's a really interesting book, all of it, just the format too, the way it's bound and the kind of paper it is. It's like a manual. So it kind of encourages us to really get it dirty and to play with it a lot.
Thank you so much, Eva. It was so, so nice to talk to you. And thanks for loving the book so much.
And Noor, it was really lovely to meet you.
Thank you. It was so great to meet you as well.
That was Noor Mourad and Yotam Ottolenghi of the Ottolenghi Test Kitchen. They've developed recipes putting those rediscovered ingredients in the kitchen to use in their book, Shelf Love. One of my favorite forms of shelf love is giving my loved ones the gift of shelf-stable products for the holidays. Usually, it's my tomato sauce that I can every summer. I'd always made tomato sauce, gallons and gallons of it, but it wasn't until I learned to can from a master preserver named Delilah Snell that I went from being a super confident cook to feeling super competent in the kitchen when it comes to preserving. Delilah is a force of nature, and somehow I feel like her relationship to preserving is a microcosm of everything she holds dear: sustainability, lack of waste, community, education, and the joy one finds in sharing abundance. Hi, Delilah.
Hey, Evan. How's it going?
It's so great to have you on the show and to talk about this new preserving book you wrote. When a lot of us hear the word preserving, we think of canning, which makes the food shelf stable. But there are more techniques to preserving than just canning, right? What are they?
Yeah, I think when people think of preserving, it's always like food in a jar, but there's a number of different, you know, methods or techniques for preserving, like fermentation, dehydration, salting and smoking food, freezing food. And, you know, I talk about all of those methods in my book, but one that I really like to do that is not in my book is preserving things in alcohol. I remember, you know, when you took that canning class in my home all those years ago, we had loquat liqueur that I had made.
That's true.
So yeah, those are the ways that you can preserve food. But yeah, I mean, all these methods of food preservation, they you know, they all have their pluses and minuses. They all use different, you know, equipment or tools. So, you know, they're all a little bit different. You know, they all keep food around longer and they all inhibit microorganisms from growing in food and enzymes from working. And that's kind of like the commonality between all these forms is keeping things from making food spoil.
Which is the easiest and most affordable preservation method?
So the two easiest forms of food preservation are also the two oldest, and that's dehydration and freezing food. Now, anybody who has a freezer can freeze food. Obviously, the equipment's a little bit more expensive, but, you know, most of us have a freezer at home and can start freezing food immediately. Dehydration, you can start immediately as well. You can do something as easy as drying herbs in a paper bag. That's how I dry my rosemary from my garden. You could get something like a dehydrator, but you could honestly start drying herbs right away.
What are some things that you would suggest that we think about freezing that maybe we don't do? And how should we prepare the foods to be frozen? Like, you know, one of the things I do every year is I really love boysenberries. And because their season is so fleeting, I usually buy a flat or two when they come to market, and then I lay them all out on trays and freeze them. And then once they're frozen solid, I throw them in Ziploc bags.
And that's called flash freezing. And I do the same thing with mulberries because, you know, they're very delicate and their season's not that long. And yeah, I find like flash freezing mulberries or berries, that's kind of like the perfect technique to preserving, you know, the integrity of that fruit. You know, it's interesting, while I was writing the book and I was doing the freezing section, I realized that, you know, I don't think we give freezing enough credit. You know, we kind of think of it almost as like a storage unit for things that, you know, maybe we'll deal with later. But after I opened Alta Baja Market, I really started to use the freezer differently. And, you know, we make the spicy pork that's really popular here, but, you know, we end up freezing hundreds of pounds of it. And it's become really useful to us. And every end of summer, I also roast and freeze hatch chilies. And I know that's a really popular thing to do. And that way I can use them year round.
One of the things that I also learned from you that's so simple and is great for holiday gift giving is using different ingredients in salts.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And writing this book, I fell in love with it, and now we do it 10 times more. But one of the things that we do at Alta Baja is we make our own lemon pepper, and it's really, really simple. It's just dehydrating, you know, different types of citrus peels and then powdering them. And, you know, I'm seeing so many salts on the market with different flavorings, and I'm sure they're adopting that same form of food preservation. But I mean, now I'm dehydrating all the time. We dehydrate fruit to put on cheese plates or vegetable chips to put on cheese plates. Every time we serve butter, we always put a little piece of dehydrated fruit on top. We use a lot of them in garnishes for our drinks or micheladas. And we've been improving our spices that we're offering because we're making a lot of them in-house using dehydration. I fell in love with it. And now it's like my new thing. My new thing that was always there, but I didn't really embrace it as much as I do now.
Yeah, it's become more of a daily practice for you.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Kale chips, all sorts of stuff. And I even have in the book dog treats. So everybody can benefit from dehydration.
Let's talk about canning next, because I think that most people, when they think of preservation, that's what they think of. Putting something in a jar and then either submerging it in water or putting it in this really scary thing called a pressure canner.
Yeah, when I tell students, you're basically putting food in a jar, you're heating it up in a piece of equipment, whether that's a boiling water bath or a pressure canner, in order to kill everything that can spoil the food in the jar. And then you're immediately locking the door so nothing else can get in. And this process is allowing the jar to stay in the cupboard. It doesn't need to be refrigerated or frozen. And it can last, you know, for up to a year. But there is two different types of canning. And I think it's incredibly important to know the difference between the two, and that's using a boiling water bath, and that's for items that are acidic, or pressure canning items that are not acidic. So for example, like beans in water or meat or fish, you know, these types of items that don't have a lot of natural acidity, you need to up the temperature in order to kill things like botulism, which can only be inert when it's above 240 degrees. And you can only achieve that when you're in this piece of equipment called a pressure canner, and it locks down. And it's kind of a big, scary contraption. But once you get the hang of it, it's actually a very powerful tool. And you can can anything basically in there.
And is an Instant Pot a pressure canner?
No, it is not. Thank you for saying that. And neither is a pressure cooker. It needs to be a pressure canner. And the two big names that make these pieces of equipment are Presto and All American.
If I wanted to give your book as a gift to someone, along with whatever materials they would need to make a project, what would be a good kit that I could put together?
So recently, I gifted my mother my book, and I actually bought her a dehydrator. I use a Presto one. It's got about 12 racks. I really love it. It's very affordable. I think it's around $80. But we are actually having a kit online for the holidays, which is the book with a little fermenter lid. It's like a plastic lid that you screw on a mason jar with a little fermentation, was a gauge or gadget. It's a little thing that you put up on top of the jar to regulate air. To make sure nothing's contaminating the jar. But I think it's going to be less than $30 online, and people can start fermenting right away. I would also look into, I think Ball has a basic beginner's canning kit, and it's a big water bath canner. It's like a big soup pot. It's what it looks like with your canning rack, and it's some of the basic tools that you need to can.
Oh, what a good idea. Well, thank you so much, Delilah.
Thanks, Evan.
Delilah Snell is the owner of Alta Baja Market in Santa Ana. She's a master preserver and has written her first book, The Beginner's Guide to Preserving. In a minute, we peek behind the scenes of the wild world of competitive table setting. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. I saw a meme last week that perfectly captured modern-day entertaining. It was a diagram of the classic table setting, complete with a cake fork and a dessert spoon, but superimposed on the left was a photo of an iPhone. The caption read, "The correct place for the iPhone is below and slightly to the left of the bread plate." It made me want to both laugh and cry, and left me wondering, does anyone do this anymore, like really set the table? The answer, oh yes. Not only do people set the table, they compete in table setting competitions where simply misplacing a soup spoon can mean the end of a perfect display. I learned about this wild world from filmmaker Scott Golic, who followed a group of determined table setters in a funny and sometimes jaw-dropping new documentary called Set. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Oh. I saw that meme too.
What an interesting subculture you've managed to capture.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was equally as surprised when I realized it was a thing myself.
How did you learn about table setting competitions?
By accident, really. I mean, I had went to the Orange County Fair here in Southern California, and that day was an exceptionally hot day, triple digit weather, you know, and so we'd had a bunch of these large beers and kind of found our way into the air conditioned rooms. And there was just a bunch of tables there, and kind of just walked up and, you know, put my beer down on the table. And all of a sudden, a bunch of people just started running towards me. What are you doing? What are you doing? This is the table setting competition. Oh, shoot. You know, picked up the beer and looked down. And sure enough, there I was in the middle of a competitive table setting competition.
I mean, it's kind of fascinating given that most of us have basically eaten on our couches or in our bedrooms for the last couple of years.
Certainly.
One of the most fascinating parts of the movie for me was the black and white footage that you show from the 1950s of women in press dresses setting the perfect table with these voiceovers, hilarious, pedantic voiceovers about Mrs. So-and-so and her daughter so-and-so are getting the table ready for the arrival of the husband.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so fascinating because that seems so staid in a way, but the kind of table decor that the people who are in current day competitions are doing is quite a different thing. Can you kind of set the scene for us and describe a bit of the table decor that you experienced?
Yeah. So just so your viewers know, if they decide to eventually watch this movie, it is not a feature-length movie on how to set the table. We kind of go through the rules of setting the tables and what the competitions, and that's over within the first 3 minutes. And it gets into like these interesting backstories, and they, you know, prepare in very interesting ways. And it's more of a people piece than it is about table setting. Table setting is kind of just the glue that holds it all together. But how the competition works is these people that are in the film, they spend about 6 months setting their table, getting ready to go into competition. 6 months. And they're given a theme. So in the film, it's international travel. And so they can do whatever they want within that theme creatively. So it could be traveling to Africa or in Italy, you know, wine tasting sort of situation. Or it's like something a little bit more creative where it's about like the monarch butterflies because they don't have borders and they go throughout. And so and then the judges come in and they are judged on the correctness. It's like where the fork goes, where the spoon goes. Then you're judged on your creativity, which is very subjective. And then there's a couple other like things like this. And these tables are pieces of art. You know, it's not just like a plate with a couple forks. They have to match the menu. When you look at the menu and whatever course you're eating, it makes sure that you have to have the right silverware for that, or else you'll get marked down. Or as one of the ladies in the film says, forking herself. So these are the, like, very elaborate pieces of art. It's not just a couple of plates and silverwares. They're like movie sets.
So let's talk about a couple of the contestants. First, let's talk about Bonnie Overman.
She is the LeBron James of table setting. If you made a table setting movie without her, you didn't make the movie.
My name is Bonnie Overman. I've been doing a tablescaping and competition for 22 years, and this year will be my 23rd. The whole process of me entering these competitions starts in the beginning of the year. Going to the website, seeing if they have information for the new competition, and I have to enter immediately to make sure I get a spot. And more info coming soon. It's not up yet. So far, I haven't seen anything yet, and I check it 10 times a day. So about 10 times a day, so that would be, there's 30 days, so that's 300 times. Would that be 300 times a month? And we're in March. So that would be probably 700 times I checked. I've never missed a year.
And what was her sort of vision board for the international travel competition?
Well, for international travel, she decided to do out of Africa. So it was kind of like a 1930s sort of a little bit of a nod to the movie Out of Africa, where, you know, they put down, there's some photographs, it's a fine dining, there's some nice plates, and it's just kind of this eloquent safari. But what's actually interesting is one of the other ladies, there's another character in the film, or subject, rather, her name is Hillary, and she gets her inspiration from going into sensory deprivation chambers.
Now that I've floated and seen the lights, images just kind of start to form in your mind, and I was flashing back a little bit to our trip to Africa and just getting the essence and the feeling, the sights, the smells. I have a clear vision of exactly what I want to do with my table, and that will be Africa. But instead of doing like a generic African table with zebra napkins and that type of thing, I really wanted to concentrate more on concerns of what's going on in Africa. Currently, there's a large amount of poaching, killing of endangered species, and just nonsense that's going on. I kind of wanted to capture that, comment on it, bring that to the forefront.
Hillary's more, she's kind of like the Banksy disruptor of the table setting world, if you can believe it or not. And so hers is kind of the poacher's like revenge, like the animal's revenge of the poacher. So on her table, instead of all these nice silverware, there's blood everywhere. There's bullets everywhere. There is, she actually collects taxidermy animals. And so it's littered with like monkeys with guns and all this sort of stuff to kind of showcase that, hey, there were some poachers here, but the animals killed them. And this is a statement piece. And so, it's interesting how two people can take the same theme and completely go in two different directions with it.
So you follow the contestants during a 6-month period, and you show all the different phases of each competitor's preparation until finally the day comes that they set their tables at the OC Fair. They invest a lot of time and money, some of them thousands of dollars, to compete. What do they get in return? Why would they want to do it?
They get a 50-cent ribbon. and so you're like, well, what's the point? Well, they love that ribbon. They all want this best of show ribbon. It is the crown of jewels. And it's bragging rights. I mean, you got best of show for a whole year. I guess it's just like anything in life that you're passionate about, you know, and being rewarded by a judge and a jury of your peers.
Well, thank you so much. It was so entertaining. And, you know, as we all know from social media, there are so many different niche activities and interests among us. And this is a subculture that I have yet to see plumbed with such depth.
It's a real life Christopher Guest film. You know, they take these tables very seriously, and it's good for the whole family and a lot of laughs.
That's filmmaker Scott Golic talking about his funny new documentary about a table-setting competition. The movie is called Set, now streaming on the Discovery Plus channel. And now for what's on the table this weekend. Let's return to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Jillian Ferguson is there now with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We took a few weeks off, and it's like a whole new market coming back today. Laura Ramirez of JJ's Lone Daughter returned to the market a few weeks ago after her annual hiatus, and she is back with this year's crop of persimmons. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Jillian. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. It's great to see
Pretty
you here.
Pretty persimmons, I see.
So I'm hoping that we can do our annual Persimmon 101, where you just remind us what this seasonal fruit is and what the varieties are that we have to choose from.
Sure. Well, my number one favorite is always Hichia this time of year. And I always make a suggestion. You know, those are the varieties that have to be really soft, and they're like acorn-shaped. Must be soft like a water balloon softness. They're custardy inside. Never bite into a hard one, or you'll never forgive anybody who handed it to you. And then there's the Fuyus. There's a giant and a regular Fuyu. Those can be eaten hard like an apple. And those are sweet like an apple. They're not really that intense honey-like flavor. And back to my favorite Hichia. Boy, I love them. Every year I suggest you cut them on top, give them a little score, and freeze them. And then I love to put rum or cognac or something like that on top, and it just enhances the flavor so much. A little creme fraiche and a little bit of nutmeg on top. Ooh, yum. But this year I found out that if I don't care about putting a little bit of the alcohol on it, that a little bit of maple syrup on top, dreamy. Wow. Yeah. Okay. We're always a little bit later to the market. Other people have them already in September, but ours take a little bit longer to ripen up. So we always come back about the second week of November.
Yeah. And I think this is really a true farmer's market treat, because no grocery store in their right mind would stock these things ripe. I mean, it's just, they're almost quivering inside their skin.
Oh my goodness. And I always have to tell people, don't touch. one touch and it'll just explode right in your hand. And that's really the way you want it, or else you're, like I said, you would never forgive it if you bit into that and it was like, oh, like biting into a green banana is not good.
Right. So before they're this ripe, they have all these tannins in them that really pucker your mouth.
Yeah, bad.
Yeah. What are the other ways in which your customers use them? Are they using them for baking too?
Oh, baking is a number one thing too. You know, it makes everything a little softer and nicer. They make great cookies, pies, puddings, all kinds of wonderful things. I love cookies myself, so the persimmon cookies this time of year are great. And then you can always, if you can't find a way to use it, you can always freeze the pulp in cups and then bring them out anytime during the year and then just make cookies, you know, in the summer.
Oh, that's so smart. That's great. And persimmons are pretty synonymous with fall. How long is the season?
Our season normally ends about Christmas time. So about Christmas time, maybe a week or two into January if we're lucky. But one cold spell and it just ripens all the fruit all at once. And then you're kind of stuck and your season's over and it rains persimmons.
All right, Laura. Well, it's wonderful to have you back. Thanks so much.
Good to see you.
That was Laura Ramirez, the lone daughter behind JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch in Redlands. You can find her at the Wednesday and Saturday downtown Santa Monica Farmers Market and on Sundays in Hollywood. Here to demystify what to do with persimmons is Diego Argotti. Diego is a chef and longtime shopper at the Farmers Market. I remember the days when you were here shopping for Bestia with a big full cart. And these days you are doing something you're calling street pasta under the name Estrano. Nice to see you.
Hi, nice to see you.
So tell us what street pasta is.
It started in the pandemic when I left Bevel. I didn't really have an identity as a chef. I kind of wanted to remember what I love cooking. My favorite thing to cook, and it was like when I was at Bestia and just doing the pasta program there. And started with three dishes, like a cheeseburger ravioli, a tortellini and pozole verde, and some chow fungi with soy sauce and vanilla bean. And then we just posted up in an alleyway, probably when we shouldn't have. Uh-huh. And that kitchen was six burners with two propane tanks. We don't have tents. It's almost like a heist. We go in, we go out.
Very punk.
Yeah, sure.
So you're still doing this in various permutations. And I know that hachias are all over your menu right now. You're always deeply invested in seasonal produce. So tell us how you're using these beautiful hachias and puyus.
I always wanted to do risotto on the street. And I just knew it was kind of like something really like dumb and hard to do and very difficult to execute, and it's kind of like we always like to have those there because it kind of reminds us of like why we do this. So one of my like classics, like a saffron parmesan risotto, I always like the flavors, but I wanted to add duck curry to it, or like pineapple duck curry with the bell peppers that you normally get like in Thai restaurants, but we replaced the pineapple with persimmons. And the cool thing about like these hachias, they're like blending them, like so much natural pectin and sugar that like you don't need a thickener for your sauce. You just cook it through with like the duck juices and the bones, and it creates like its own base for something familiar but also magical.
Sure. And you peel them before you puree them?
No, I don't have time for that. No way. But yeah, that's one part of it. And then I love cooking vegan food now. So we've been doing bang bang noodles for quite a while. We'll do them with like mushroom barbacoa. This one's tastes like Tom Kha Gai. It's like, we call it green curry, but it's coconut, lemongrass, lime leaves. And then we pickle some unripe fuyus. We pickle the fuyus and plop them on top for like acidity.
I think what's so interesting and exciting to hear you talk about these things is that for most home cooks, and maybe I'm just speaking for myself, when we get a persimmon, the easiest thing for us to do is just eat it, right?
Right, which I do on the freeway.
Yeah, exactly. We all do it in our cars on the way home from the farmer's market. But you're using them to balance out savory dishes in a really interesting way.
We do, like, and then like sweet does happen naturally. For example, we're working on a hachia persimmon push pop to taste like an orange creamsicle, but it's going to be like hachia creamsicle, and then we're topping it off with like smoked trout roe. So that's where you get that, say, even though it is a dessert, you kind of want the acidity or like brininess or kind of, you know, layers of flavor. And you also want to think when you eat, and that's kind of what I want to do with persimmons, is have people thinking about them in a different way because they deserve that attention.
And they're here for such a short time.
Oh yeah. I do the food program for this Bark Alma's cider and beer, and I'll make all the leftover hachia blended stuff that I don't use, I'll make mustard with, and we make waffles over there with like ciders. So like, you know, we'll do like a little bit of like a nice Serrano ham with a nice waffle and like hachia mustard seed.
That's great. Well, we have so many ideas now. Thank you, Diego.
Thank you.
That was Diego Argotti of Estrano, a street pasta pop-up. The best way to find Diego is, of course, on Instagram. His handle is Estrano Things. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Coming up, imagine a Queen Amon flaky layers of dough laminated with butter and sugar. And then you add masa. That's next when Good Food continues. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Bread. Seemingly so simple, but it has a way of capturing our imagination. Just four ingredients, flour, water, salt, and yeast, performed differently in the hands of each baker. For Arturo Enciso, it was a wood-fired cob oven that sparked his interest and launched him on the journey to gusto bread. His story may have begun with a loaf of sourdough, but these days the racks at Gusto are lined with conchas and the smell of masa lingers in the air. Together with his partner, Ana Salatino, Arturo shares his story from Backyard Cottage Bakery to Long Beach Panaderia in this week's In the Weeds.
Hi, my name's Arturo Enciso. I am a baker and co-owner of Gusto Bread.
And my name is Ana Salatino, and I am co-owner of Gusto Bread.
My passion for bread started with an oven. It was an earthen oven, a wood-fired oven. This oven was in a backyard that we shared the garden space with the homeowner. We lived in the back house, and this oven just really drew my attention. It was this glowing oven to me, and I hadn't been curious about baking prior to that, but living on that property, I got really curious, and the fellow who built the oven or organized the building of the oven, he had some books on baking that he handed me when I was talking to him about wanting to learn to use it. And that was how it started for me. I first started giving bread away. This oven could fit about 6 loaves. You know, after firing it with wood for like 4 hours, it took to get hot enough for bread baking. But it could really only bake like 6 loaves at a time. And then it would drop heat pretty quickly. So then after that, maybe drop like 50, 75 degrees. And then I'd have to bake other things like pastry. I started exploring that. And then later down the road, we would send out a newsletter. And that was like a growing fan base. And people, you know, caught wind of that.
I would say that I got more of a sense of the scope of possibility of Arturo's baking once he felt almost complete with what he had done with the cob oven and how many folks we were able to reach through the newsletter every week. I was kind of the mindset that perhaps he could work for a small bakery nearby, or even we were thinking of traveling across the country and living somewhere in the East Coast since there's so many more bakeries out there. He gave that a shot, kind of humoring me. He wasn't really fulfilled working for other people. He had a very clear sense of, you know, what he wanted to bring, and he felt that it was time for him to just go ahead and do it, even if it was small steps, that it was still achievable and that it was more worthwhile. So the support we were getting as a cob oven bakery with just the few loaves a week that we were able to produce and the amount of people that we were reaching, that's when we decided to take it to the next level with the cottage bakery. And within a year or so, Arturo started doing a farmer's market in which he would make all the bread himself, bake it that morning, bake all the pastries, load the car up, go to the farmer's market, and sell every single loaf himself. Our connections led us all the way to where we're at currently with the bakery storefront, basically. All the community connections that we've had have nourish the business as we're nourishing people through the food as well. So it's been completely full circle.
When I would bake everything myself and go sell it at the market, I took a lot of pleasure in that. I really, when we were doing newsletters, even, you know, before I did farmers markets, in the newsletter, it was sort of that component of like being able to share a story behind like something we sourced, like the fruit from this farmer or like the wheat or the grains. So when I'd go to the market, it was a similar thing. I'd love talking about it and about what we were making and stories behind it. So I took a lot of pleasure in that. It was definitely exhausting some days, but other days being able to hand someone a fresh bread that I worked so hard at and them just the smile on their face and what they'd tell me, how they were going to eat it, who they'd share it with, it just gave me energy to do it again. The more I did a lot of the French things, it just didn't feel like me. So I just felt like, you know what? I'm going to use my knowledge to apply to breads that I grew up with, using sourdough like conchas and other pan dulces that we were working on. And so I developed a menu as well as drinks like horchata, café de olla, which is like a coffee, spiced coffee. And what I imagine, like when we made our conchas, it's like, I like to imagine it's like what a concha was like 100 years ago, if it even did exist 100 years ago. But it'd be, you know, the simplicity of that. It's just eggs, flour, starter, salt. Nowadays, conchas and some pan dulces, unfortunately, at some major panaderias especially, they've really sacrificed quality. So our culture, too, has been watered down, or like it's not what I imagine it used to be, like what my dad grew up eating, probably better bread than there is today. For someone visiting Gusto for the first time, I'd say try a concha for sure, and a nix de malacuin. It's a pastry inspired by Queen Amon, which is from Breton, I believe, Breton and France. So it's like when you'd like take a bread dough and literally laminate butter into it and do it, give it a few quick folds and sprinkle sugar while you're doing that. And that's apparently the invention of like the Queen Amon. It's this large thing you'd bake in like a pie tin. It's really evolved nowadays. You know, you find them at some specialty or artisan bakeries, and they're smaller, they're more like personal sized. So I was very fascinated by that when I was learning about them. So I literally took our bread dough from our hueso and I folded in butter and sugar. You know, I tried it and it was fabulous. But then I started learning about nixtamalization for corn. It's when you cook corn in an alkaline solution like calcium hydroxide. And that's an ancient knowledge for making masa, like for corn tortillas. So I was learning that and I just thought, why don't I put masa in this Queen Amon dough that I have been working on? And so I did, folded it into that bread dough with the butter and sugar. And I just, yeah, I loved the flavor of it instantly once I baked it. And even in the oven, it reminded me of, it just was reminiscent of like a corn tortilla or something.
That was Arturo Enciso and Ana Salatino, the duo behind the Long Beach Panaderia Gusto Bread. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, and to Nisha Venkat and Anna Bus for production assistance on today's episode. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Gary Masiha, Kenny Ng, and Nick Lamponi. I'm Evan Kleiman. It is still Hanukkah. If you're celebrating, I hope you've had at least one jelly-filled donut this week. Take care, and I'll be back next week with another episode of Good Food.